Community connections, CKMS. Local sounds, thoughts, passions, and success. Celebrate local, your neighbor's got a story to tell. Community connections, CKMS.
Happy Monday, Waterloo Region. It is the 18th of March, 2024. You're listening to CKMS Community Connections. My name is Bob Junkman. Today in the studio, we've got Sepper Rabod and Jung Sung from the University of Waterloo Department of Theatre and Performance. And we'll be talking about their upcoming performance called Immolation in just a few minutes. They're going to listen to some more. Tim McInnes. This is his new piece that he's just released called Great Strides. Tim McInnes, his new piece called Great Strides, just released a few days ago, and we were wondering what kind of music that might have been. It sounds kind of like ragtime, but it's called Great Strides, so it's probably stride piano. Not that I would recognize one piano technique from another. Got in the studio with me Sepper Rabod and Jung Sung.
Hi.
From the Department of Theatre and Performance at the University of Waterloo. Welcome to CKMS Community Connections.
Thanks, Bob.
Glad to be here.
I am curious what that department is, Department of Theatre and Performance.
That's a good question. Yeah. June, would you like to speak on that?
Yeah, I can take that. I, as a student with the university, I am very involved with your program, and it...
Yeah, centers around theatre and performance, but it expands to different avenues of that as well. So there's on-stage performance, but also there is more abstract performance that is covered in some of the courses as well. And it's a very welcoming community, all different types of perspectives from both the staff and the students, and it's overall just a very welcoming community.
Yeah. It's a department, so similar to the chemistry department or the geography department. And so there are multiple courses offered through the department, not just the course that you're taking.
Yes, that's right. So students can have the opportunity to be a part of the production as I am, but there's also a variety of courses that go into acting, some go into directing, and some go into the more technical aspects of theater mm-hmm. as well. So there's a wide variety of exploring the kind of world of theater.
Okay, so there's stagecraft like lighting and sound and blocking and that sort of thing as well?
Yes, that's right.
Oh, cool. And then you're in which course? What are you actually doing there?
With the production, it counts as, I believe it's Theater 417, I believe, and it's just the being involved in the production. And I'm also in Theater 222, which is performing the body, which has helped a lot in tandem with what I'm doing in the production as well.
Performing the body is the name of the course?
That's the name of a separate course I'm in. The course for immolation is, I think, I'm trying to remember. I usually don't call it by its course name. I just call it immolation.
Right.
So whatever production is happening that term, you would be in Theater 417.
Right. And immolation is the name of the piece that you'll be performing.
Yes, that's right.
And when's that happening?
March 20th to March 23rd.
And taking place at?
The University of Waterloo Modern Languages building in the Theater of Arts.
Okay. Have that in the show notes, radiowaterloo.ca/CCC. And I'll ask you a few more times during the course of the day just to make sure that I've got it ingrained in my mind.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Also got Sepper Raybod here.
Hi.
How are you involved?
I'm the text developer and assistant director for Immolation. So the text of the play was created primarily by the actors themselves. It's a devised piece, which means that there was no script, only a spark of an idea going into the creation process. And so there was some research that the actors had done beforehand with this one idea of freedom fighters. We wanted to look at resistance and revolution and rebellion and working against the systems that are oppressing us as a core idea. And so a lot of the text and the words spoken in the piece themselves were brought forth from the actors mm-hmm. in their research. And then it was my job as text developer to flesh some of those ideas out, give it more of a narrative structure, put it all in one script that we can all work from. And in my capacity as assistant director, Pam Patel, who is the artistic director of Empty Space out in Kitchener, is the director of the piece. And she was brought in as a guest as well by the department at the University of Waterloo. And I was her assistant. So working together in tandem to flesh out the ideas and making sure that we're telling a story that is both true to the core of the idea of rebellion and revolution and resistance, but also tells a story that our actors feel are true to the research that they brought in.
Okay, so you said there's no script.
There was no script in the beginning.
Oh.
But as we worked and we grabbed stuff from the research, I developed one and we put it together now, and it follows a similar to a piece of music, like classical music. We've got it in four movements and what we call interludes. So instead of scenes or acts, we're working with movements of text, and it resembles kind of a piece of classical music and its cyclical and structure nature.
Did you write the script in its entirety?
I typed it out, for sure.
Okay. that's not quite the same as the writing and creative process.
Well, it's a collaborative process. So devised is devised way of working brings everybody together at the table. So we wanted to work against a hierarchy of theater that is so prevalent in our theater making in Canada. And we wanted everyone to have a chance to do something or to have a voice in kind of every part of the process. So with the writing, some of the scenes were literally written by the actors in that scene, and then I might have edited it. And there are some other scenes that I felt I needed to write in its entirety to help tell the narrative of the story that we were creating.
Right. Who came up with the narrative? Who came up with the overall story arc?
It emerged in rehearsal. So our rehearsals looked like moving around the space, having some improvs that would tell a picture of an idea. And then it was in putting these different improvs together, we realized, oh, there's a narrative here. We didn't even have a title. The title came about in February, and we started working in January.
Okay.
So about a month, we really had no idea what was happening.
Script writing would be one of the elements of the course that I guess you're involved in, but that June is taking.
For at least my role as like a student in the class, script writing isn't usually a part of it. I think just the nature of a devised piece, a lot of the script work and the text in Immolation, a lot of it came out of improv, and then Saper kind of altered the text to make it flow a bit better. But through the improv, a lot of our story beats and text emerged. And then we would also insert the research, and Saper would make it sound nicer, and all that.
Take me through that process. So you started off with the idea, and then you said there was improv. How do you get from making stuff up to having a cohesive narrative that you can actually present to the public, that you can perform?
Yeah, it was very interesting. The first few rehearsals was pure improv. There was no real prompts. It was just working together as a cast to find relationships and connections and forming those bonds. And slowly, the Saper and Pam would offer just very small prompts to kind of lead us in directions that could be interesting for building the story. But for a good chunk of it, we didn't really know what the story was going to be, because the improv, it was like forming a bunch of puzzle pieces, but not knowing what the final image is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
It's very interesting and lots of work. It's a privilege to be a part of something so unique that I've never done before.
Yeah, I guess you're very dependent on your co-collaborators to make this all work.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. The mechanics of it. Did you videotape the improv rehearsals to be able to get the words down into a script? How does that work? Does Saper sit there and type madly as you're performing?
That was certainly some of the nights, okay. Yeah. We also had a really strong group of students working as our stage managers. So we had Emily, who was our main stage manager, and our Paula and Hannah, who are our assistant stage managers. And they were working diligently, taking notes while it was happening. So I would be mad dash writing down what they're saying during an improv, and then Hannah and Paula would be taking notes on what's happening. And so we would create this wealth of knowledge and of resource online, where we were all working together on this Basecamp, which is our software that we were using to keep in touch. And on that Basecamp was all the notes we had. So part of the work inside the rehearsal was developing all of that content and mad dash writing things and trying to keep track of what's happening, and then going home, processing, seeing this is relevant to the thing we were doing yesterday. So there's starting to see patterns emerge. And the way those things would emerge is that the actors would have impulses they would follow. So like June was saying, there wasn't necessarily a prompt always for those improvs, but people would just stare at each other, and then they would move around and then strike a pose as an example. And this would start telling a story. And the important part about this piece, and as most devised theater might be as well, is that there's always room for the audience to put in their own interpretation. There's an invitation to the audience to say, this is what we're presenting you. What do you think we're trying to say? And that's what I find so powerful about this piece, is that it's like music. It evokes a memory, emotion, personal relationship with the audience that we necessarily are not prepared or prescribing for them. It is in this kind of working based off of impulse that we hope to tap into our audiences in the same way.
You said that there's a lot left up to the audience to fill in for themselves. Mm-hmm. And how is the stage arranged? Is there lots of props? Is there lots of painted backdrops? Scrims, curtains. How does the stage look?
Anything you can imagine, I think we're trying to use. So we've got, a scrim. So this like semi-opaque fabric screen, mm-hmm. that we use behind it. We've got some images that'll help create really cinematic kind of scenes.
Mm-hmm.
And then we've got this thrust stage. So it's an extended stage that comes down. It helps us create a lot of angles so that we can work together on diagonal angles for the blocking. And yes, there's like painting, lots of props. We've got these cardboard pieces that look like concrete walls. Immolation, implies a certain level of destruction.
Yes.
So there's our set looks like what might, be after a riot or a revolution or just a really big picnic. It's like that part's open for interpretation as well. But what we like about it is that Immolation also does imply space for hope and growth,
right.
The same way a forest fire might.
Right.
And so we've got this mulch this rubber mulch from old tires covering the entire stage on the bottom. So the thrust comes out and everything else underneath it is mulch. And this mulch has covered up a painted set. So as the actors walk around and move, the set reveals itself. The stage itself is slowly revealed. And mulch has a quality of gardening to it. It reminds me a lot of gardening. Yeah. So we're working with this theme of destruction and growth. And it's a cyclical part of nature. And our show is created and devised in a cyclical way as well, the same way a movement, a piece of music would be in movements. Mm-hmm. It takes us through the seasons, spring. We start actually in summer, fall, winter, and spring, and then we start in summer again. We're really interested in the idea of the cyclical nature of human experience.
Okay. And it's called immolation,
yes,
which evokes all sorts of images, especially from recent news events.
Absolutely.
I think I'd like to get into that a little bit more.
Let's do it.
But I wanted to play some more music, too.
Great.
We've got Riff Action, who've also released some new music. This is called That's the Way She Goes. Action, not from their latest album, which is by a team, but from something a little bit older than that. Dale and Daryl Menzies founded the group in 2007 after years of jamming together. They're based in Winnipeg, Manitoba, and hope to get a lot more music by them in the near future. In the studio, you've got Sepper Raybod and June Sung from the University of Waterloo Department of Theater and Performance. I'm getting that.
Yes, you are.
We're talking about the performance and the course, Immolation. And immolation is something that's been in the news fairly recently. Can you tell us more about sort of the background for the whole piece?
Since each actor was given the direction to do some research on various freedom fighters before we started rehearsing, I would say a large background on the piece is each actor's perspective on freedom fighting, and even Sapere's perspective as well as Pam Patel's. But it was interesting bringing that research into these improvs, because obviously we have bias on who we pick and who we portray as freedom fighting. And I think that they all ranged from widely different backgrounds. For example, the freedom fighter I researched was a South Korean transgender activist, and widely different from all the other people that were researched, because my freedom fighter is alive currently in this today and age, and a lot of people picked historical figures. And I think the chemistry of taking these characters and putting them together and seeing what freedom fighting looks like in that context, I think was really interesting. But it created a lot of very compelling moments in a lot of our improv rehearsals. So,
can you give us a background on the freedom fighter that you were researching?
Yeah, so the freedom fighter I researched is named Jungle. A lot of the queer community in South Korea only go by a mononym, so just a single name, and typically like words of sorts. So Jungle kind of creates safe spaces for queer people in Korea, because the queer community there is still very underground. It's not very publicly accepted in South Korea. So Jungle hosts like parties celebrating not exclusively queer people, but it's very much a safe space for them, called Transparent. And it's kind of a place to celebrate and be comfortable. And she does a lot of work in that space and does a lot of activism across seas and stuff as well. And I think it's very inspiring.
How did you come across Jungle?
To be honest, there's not a lot of transgender like history in Korea. Most of it was either erased or just wasn't very accepted, so it was just kind of suppressed. So when looking into transgender activists in Korea, two things that are very relevant to my background, Jungle was one of the more prevalent ones, at least outside of Korea.
Okay.
So it just felt like a right choice to pick someone that is a good representation of what that fight looks like overseas.
Okay. Seems to me that if South Korea is still somewhat repressed in queer activism, Jungle may be in some danger for being so visible.
Yeah, actually, Jungle tried to transition early on in her life, around 20 years old, but was forced to detransition by her family, and is now transitioning again in her 40s. It's very interesting, I think, the queer community in Korea, because I think a lot of people picture South Korea as a very queer accepting place because of how mainstream it is in popular culture, but it's in reality very still pretty not accepting of queer identities. So it was a very interesting process looking into that.
Is that changing at a reasonable clip, or is it just lagging? And
I hope so. If it's changing very slowly, if anything. Yeah.
Okay. And that's a lot of traditional views are still in prevalence there.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
So the piece is called Immolation, and that I learned recently means sacrifice, but I always pictured it as someone setting themselves on fire. And we've seen some recent examples. We've seen one recent example of that. Coincidence?
Good question. I think it's important to differentiate immolation itself from self-immolation. Immolation being the act to destroy by fire, whereas self-immolation does take on, becomes a performative act of protest. So you're, I think, referencing Aaron Bushnell
in
the States.
Yes.
So the title and the idea and all of that stuff came before his act of self-immolation. What's not a, so that is a coincidence. what's not a coincidence is that the themes and the and things that we're taking on in terms of resistance, in terms of activism, in terms of having your voice be heard, in terms of, you know, destroying in order to create something new again, which I think is kind of at the heart of most of these protest acts, mm-hmm. particularly the one that would be in self-immolation, you know, is I will destroy this body in order to hope for a response that brings something new. And so that's a very big part of our show, is taking a look at all the different ways we can spark this hope. We can burn something down. We can create something new by the act of, whether it's, you know, metaphorically burning down the system or literally, you know, burning down the bounds, the things that bind us, rather.
Right.
So it is very peculiar timing for that case of Aaron Bushnell's to be in the news and doing the rounds these days. And in fact, our poster shows a body falling backwards into flames. So it's quite evocative in that. And it's not something we were necessarily leaning into with the case of Aaron Bushnell and protesting his views on what's happening in the Middle East. But
right,
it's very much relevant.
So immolation implying the destruction, your peace immolation goes beyond that into restoration and regrowth as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think hope is important. I think that's where everything worth doing stems from. Even the people, you know, who take great lengths to share their despair have hope. That's my personal belief. So I think even in acts of natural disaster as well, things that we may attribute to having no conscience or agenda, like a forest fire, it does act as opportunity for hope, for regrowth.
Right, right. Is that, that's not commonly seen that way, is it? It's when you speak of immolation, you speak of protest, you're not really evoking the idea of regrowth and rebirth and renewal.
In the act of immolation?
In the act of immolation, just in the whole idea of protest, of trying to make change.
Yeah.
We only ever see in the news the protests, torching cars, graffiti. Mm-hmm. We only see the negative aspects, mm-hmm. the breakdown, the destruction.
Yeah.
Mainstream media tends to not focus on the stories of the regrowth, of the renewal.
I think that's a really good point, Bob, because I think sometimes these things, for example, like the torching of a car or throwing a brick in some big bank's window, mm-hmm. These are vehicles for a message of hope. You know, the things written on those posters, the things that people are chanting. I think you're right. In the cycle of mainstream media, we can become quite desensitized to it. But when people, and like myself personally, and this show is so much also about violence, you know,
mm-hmm.
immolation is an act of violence. Forest fires are an act of violence. And so many of the systems that we live in, at all the different levels, you know, are based on, enact, or respond to a sort of violence. And so a lot of the language of protest becomes violence, because that is the way that these things can be heard, these messages can be heard. But inside every freedom chant, or inside every chant for equality, for the end of gender apartheid around the world, the end of income instability, all these chants carry within them a kernel of hope about something better. And I think that's where every desire to go onto the street comes from.
When the protests are aimed at those who can make the difference, the politicians, the banksters, does that message get across, that message of renewal and hope? Or do the folks that are supposed to make the difference, that we elect to make the difference, do they see only the destructive part and then dismiss the whole movement?
Right.
Because of that.
Right. I mean, my personal opinion is that it depends on where they are in the political spectrum and what they were elected to do. I think there are some of these people and some of these bodies that are really invested in keeping the status quo because they believe in the system as it is right now. They believe that it works.
Worked for them.
It works for them.
Yeah.
And I think that there are plenty of us not in that space, particularly like myself, who believe that there is better and that this system is actually working against the people that it's supposed to uphold. And I think those people, there are those on the political spectrum, be they politicians, be they business people, or people in the working class or artists that believe in a better system. And I think those voices are being heard.
And then the whole piece, Immolation, does it leave us at the end with the growth, with the renewal, with the hope that something better will come along?
Yeah, I'd like to think so. I think each movement kind of shows the destruction and regrowth in different ways, very different ways. The movement that my character focuses a lot in talks about like regrowth in queer communities, because that's what my character is very focused on. And while there is a lot of destruction, I think telling a story that shows regrowth and joy, I think, is some of the best forms of protest, because it shows that even in these systems of harsh oppression, we can still find happiness within them, and even if it's very hard to. And I could share a little bit about what that looks like in the piece, if you'd like.
Yeah, I'd like that.
Yeah, so I'll give a little bit of context, not giving too much away. But in one of the moments of the show, my character tells a story about the background of the backstory of my character, I suppose.
Right.
And I guess I could just recite it. So, there was a little girl, but everyone told her that she was a boy. This didn't make any sense to her, but she didn't know any better. So she wandered through the world in their image and not her own. She was loved when she played with the right toys, wore the right clothes, and did the right things. And when she was herself, the self that made her happiest, that love became something else. Disgust. To protect herself, she was that boy. And everyone loved her. Everyone but herself. But it wasn't enough. Believe me, there is no love out there that makes it worth it. So she left. She found this place. And that boy that she was trying to be, that boy that protected her for so many years, can rest. She didn't need him anymore. She could be loved for who she is. So that story that I tell in the play is kind of sharing the background of my character with another character that's going through something similar to mine, and to show that even though there is so much disgust and hatred, there is still something better. It's not always downhill.
Yeah.
There's always hope.
I got the impression that does your character have a name?
I don't believe so.
Oh.
Most of the characters are nameless.
Okay, leaving that up to the audience to fill in as well.
That's right.
I get the impression that your character needed to leave, to depart, to find a new environs, to become who she really was.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't sound particularly revolutionary. It doesn't sound like there's destruction taking place there. It sounds more like resignation than protest.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because it's kind of a destruction in a different way. It's a destruction of the self, where my character breaks down that identity that she held before to birth something new, to be reborn into something different. And while it's not a very violently destructive nature, it is still deconstructing, in a way, something that existed before to allow something new to be able to exist.
I think something interesting as well is that, you know, when speaking about revolution, a big question for us during making of Immolation was, what does resistance look like? Resistance can look like 100,000 people marching in the street, but it can also look like someone walking into a space where they don't necessarily feel like they belong and changing the space from within. And it could look as simple as taking on an identity that they feel like they most are, is who they are. And in the littlest ways, it is huge on the impact of our social fabric. And that resistance can look as small as, you know, an ant carrying a crumb, and as large as terraforming Mars, you know. there's a wide spectrum of what revolution and immolation can look and feel like.
Right. The play can only address so much, though. I mean,
and we do it in 60, 65 minutes. So there is a rigor in the play itself, but and also an open-endedness where it says this can go on forever.
You said it's not a play in traditional acts, but in movements. Can you explain the difference there?
Sure. I think what we would call a well-made play, you know, it's Aristotelian, like it's from the minds of the Greeks, which dominates our Western culture of theater making, would say that, you know, there's an act one that does all the exposition, then there's like maybe in a three-act structure, right? Act two that takes care of the rising action, and then act three that takes care of the climax and the resolution. And whereas that's a great narrative structure to tell a specific particular story, these movements tell their own three-act journey within themselves. And so each movement is a standalone piece that together tells the whole story. And we could take, you know, the movement that June was speaking about and flesh that out into its own 60-minute piece quite easily if we wanted to. And it's like a work of Beethoven, you know? You can go and play just the one movement and get a feel for the thing, but you need to all the movements to hear the breadth of the message.
Right. Is each movement, does it take you through the whole process of the breakdown and the hope and the renewal?
Yeah, yeah.
So we go through this four times in the course of an hour.
Yes, you do. But in very different ways. There are some that look internal, that go, what are the ways I need to resist against myself and break things down, like June was just speaking about, which is quite powerful and intimate on its own. And then there are other movements which are about taking down a system and overthrowing things that silence us. And so that movement is more external and going outwards and takes a different scale. And of course, like because it's theater, we have the elements of sound from our great student sound designer, Jill, and Siobhan, who was our lighting designer, greatly impact the story of the seasons. So where we begin in this heat of summer where things are explosive and move through all the fall and the winter when things are most isolated. So we can see in this parable of nature how revolution can be both isolated and explosive and everything in between.
Right. What happens after the performance is done?
Like after closing night and beyond?
After closing night. I mean, there's the big cast party, no doubt. but you've poured an entire one semester or an entire year into creating this. Chance of a road trip, a world tour?
I would say first, a lot of rest. We've been working very hard, everyone, cast, crew, everybody, working very hard for the past 2-3 months on this production, so definitely rest. If given the opportunity to flesh this out, as Sapere was saying, into like either one movement or the whole thing into a larger piece, I think would be a very interesting idea, because revolution doesn't stop. It doesn't stop once closing night is over. It doesn't stop when the lights go down. It keeps going. And we hope that energy will be found in not only the cast and crew, but also the audience as well. Our aim is to rile up that energy, to get people to think about the systems that they exist in and if they should act or not.
Yeah. I think you've probably picked a nice area for this. Waterloo Region has a number of different organizations that protest and try to effect change. If you were to travel with this and go, say, south of the border, how well do you think something like this would be accepted in other venues?
I think it would vary quite heavily. I know, luckily, the space that we're performing this in, a wide variety of perspectives is quite welcome, but I know the wide variety of perspectives aren't quite as welcome in other places. But I think that's even more reason to pursue it and to bring these perspectives to people that either don't agree with or have never been exposed to. Because a lot of times, hatred isn't from pure hatred, it's a lot of times from misunderstanding.
Yeah.
So while it might be a lot more difficult, I think it's a very important thing to bring these stories to places that might not be safe to do so.
Mm-hmm.
I also think that, you know, no matter where you are on your side of resistance, or even like we were talking about the political spectrum, I think most people, especially in somewhere like the States, are hungry for change. And sometimes all you do need is someone to say, this kind of change is okay, or this kind of change is possible for you. So we've been playing, you know, in the theme of immolation, of being the spark, of sending the spark. And while it might be quite controversial in some places, like, for example, the Deep South, mm-hmm. you know, I think people there are also ready for a change. We're seeing it in the news. We're seeing it, you know, in play out in, across our pop culture about how people want something to change.
Yeah. Theater is very ephemeral. When you're done, you're done. That doesn't give, to me at any rate, a good degree of closure. You've put a lot of work into this. What will there be to show for this come April?
I think once the show is over and we get to April, I think the experiences that at least I have personally had while working on this piece will stay with me forever. The ability to work with people in such an accepting environment and to tell this kind of story, even though the show will be over, in a way the show goes on in me personally. Mm-hmm. And I think, if anything, working on Immolation has gotten me more energized into fighting for free rights for mm-hmm. queer, trans people, for people of color, and for freedom of all people.
Yeah. Is there any hope of alternative media? So this comes out as a theatrical presentation, but will there be a book? Will there be a movie? Will there be a graphic novel?
Are you pitching something to us, Bob?
I'm not sure.
I mean, we haven't had that discussion yet because we've been working really hard to get to opening, but, you know, there's always the possibility of something new coming. And because, you know, this was created collaboratively, the intellectual property of it kind of belongs to all of us. So that's an interesting idea. You know, I think it could do well in Europe.
I'd love to take it. I'm always angling for radio theater. Locally produced radio theater.
I love radio theater, and I'd love to bring it here if you want us, but...
We'll talk.
We'll talk, yeah, absolutely.
Our people will talk to your people.
Totally, totally. We'll have lunch.
Exactly. Okay, I think I'm going to play another bit of music. Here's a piece called I Believe by a group called Glow, which I haven't heard, so we're all in for a surprise.
My dreams, my world in my head, my mind, all my words, my gifts, my feelings, and eternal bliss. Is any of it real, or just something we're meant to feel to stay alive? Is any of it true? Some people say that there's no such thing, but I believe in God. I believe in true love, and I believe that life is more than we will ever define. That whisper in my ears, they tell me how to see all these worlds that lie in between these mundane material things. And I saw my grandfather 4 years after he died. And I turn lights on and off with just my mind. Is any of it real? Or just some cruel got me deceived? Is any of it true? 'Cause some people say that there's no such thing, but I believe. Said that stuck, but is that really so bad if it still can make you happy? So say and believe what you want. It's your life, so live it however you want. But spare me the doubt in your head, 'cause I believe. Love and that life is more than we will ever define. 'Cause I believe in God.
I Believe by Glow, new to our library, thanks to our music director, Richard Giles. In the studio, we have Sepa Rabod and June Sung from the University of Waterloo Department of Theatre and Performance.
You're nailing it, Bob.
Now that the show is almost over, I've got it. Tell me more. You've got Immolation happening when, where?
Yeah, so Immolation will be from March 20th through 23rd. And I believe showtimes every single day is at 7:30, and we do have a matinee on Friday at 11:30. Tickets, if you are interested, can be purchased at uwimmolation.ca, and prices for general admission is $15. For students, it's $10, and if you're in high school, it is only $5. Okay. So,
where do we go?
uwimmolation.ca.
That's on the website. What about physically? Where do we trudge to take our seats?
And that'll be at the University of Waterloo. You can get it at the box office beforehand in the Heggie Hall building. It's on the first floor if you find the box office. And if you'd like to get tickets day of the show, they will have tickets available in the building at the Modern Language Building and the Theater of Arts. So they'll have a little booth that you can buy them beforehand.
Okay. How big is the theater?
Pretty big.
I think it's like 200 seats. We've limited some of the seating to help us kind of keep a central focus in terms of the staging and such. But it's we can fit quite a like. Don't be shy. Just come on down.
comes in. The thrust stage, you said, is that does that actually extend into the audience? So you've got like a 270-degree surround of audience as you're performing?
That's right, yeah. The building itself, the theater itself is built that way, so that the almost even 180, I would say, of seating. We've extended the stage, the proscenium, a little bit, so it comes more... The elevated part of the stage comes down more so. So it's like a semi-thrust. I would say It's not really a true thrust, but it's like an elongated proscenium.
Okay. Has that affected the seating capacity? I mean, if you're limiting the audience anyway, I guess it doesn't make that much difference.
Yeah. We've just removed a couple of sections on either side of the seating. We've just blocked some of that off. But honestly, it's only made the show more concentrated, I would say, in a good way.
Okay. What happens next? Will there be another performance with the next course to do this?
Yeah, I think there will be another production in the fall. I'm graduating this term, so I won't be a part of it. So I don't know many details, but there will be one in the fall.
Okay. And this is something that students can sign up for, take the course, and there will be a whole production associated with the course. And sorry, what is the course name?
417 Theater Performance 417. And
417.
It's interesting because you don't have to be a theater major to audition. Two of our cast members are in psychology, I believe, and I'm also not technically in theater. I'm in like a weird kind of triple major thing, but I just have access to theater courses. Yeah, it's open to any students, engineering, math, environments, all welcome.
Okay. And that's done through the academic acceptance procedure. You know, you have to sign up for the course.
And audition, yes.
And audition.
Yes.
Oh, tell me about auditions, quickly.
Yeah, auditions for this production was interesting, because usually it's script work. You memorize a monologue or a part of a script, and that's what you use. But the audition process was interesting because, again, it was just improv. So seeing how well you can adapt to the other people in the room and make those connections and those stories was basically the whole audition. There wasn't even any voice aspect of the audition, which was very surprising to me.
Hmm. Were there people that applied and didn't make it?
That's right, yes.
Oh, dear. What happens to those people? They've signed up for a course, and are they no longer able to participate in that course?
Typically, audition processes happen before the term starts. So it would be before you are enrolled in any of the courses anyway. So if you are accepted as a role, they enroll you into the course.
Okay. And then you end up doing something other than performing.
Yeah. A lot of the times the people that audition and don't get parts, they still are involved with the show. I know some people go into the tech aspect of it, and some people just go on with their lives. So.
Right. I guess everybody has a role to play. And some of those roles don't involve being on stage.
That's right.
Yeah. Thank you very much for coming in. The hour is up. So you've been...
Thanks for having us, Bob. Appreciate you.
You're very welcome. Quickly, one more time, how do we see it? Where do we go? What do we do?
Head to uwimmolation.ca for tickets. At the Theater of the Arts is where Immolation is being held. Wednesday, March 20th to Friday, March 23rd.
Okay. You've been listening to CKMS Community Connections on CKMS FM Radio Waterloo. CKMS Community Connections is a production of Radio Waterloo, sponsored by Radio Waterloo, and is produced by Jennifer Strong. She's the executive producer. The associate producers are Jeff Stager. Our theme music at the beginning was written by Steve Todd. My name is Bob Jonkman. And we air every Monday at 11 o'clock and alternate Fridays at 3 p.m. I'll talk to you again then. Yeah.